Welcome back, everyone, for another deep dive. This time, you've given us some really intriguing source material. We're going to be looking at texts from the time between the Old and New Testaments.
Yes.
That offer a glimpse into Jewish life during that era. We've got Tobit, additions to Daniel, Baruch. It's a real mix.
It is.
Think of it as like a historical deep dive, but with some ethical twists and turns along the way.
Yeah, it's a period that's often overlooked, but it's so crucial for understanding the evolution of Jewish thought and practice.
Mm.
And these texts, they're not just dusty relics.
Right.
They offer a window into how Jews living outside of Israel and the diaspora navigated those challenges of maintaining their identity and faith amidst all these foreign cultures and influences.
Yeah. I'm especially curious about those ethical dilemmas that they faced. I mean, it must have been a constant balancing act.
Absolutely.
Trying to stay true to their traditions while also adapting to their surroundings.
Absolutely. And that's where Dr. De Silva's lectures on the Apocrypha come in. Mm-hmm. He does a fantastic job of really unpacking these texts and showing how they reflect the social, political, and religious dynamics of the time.
Okay. So let's start with the Book of Tobit. It's set during the Assyrian exile. And we meet Tobit, this devout Israelite who's really trying to live a righteous life even in a foreign land.
Tobit's story is just such a powerful example of diaspora piety. He meticulously follows those dietary laws.
Yeah.
He gives so generously to the poor. He even risks his own safety to bury executed Jews.
His commitment to those practices, especially burying those who had been executed, like that really stood out to me. What do you think that tells us about his understanding of his faith, especially in exile?
It shows that for Tobit, faith wasn't just about private rituals. It was about living out God's commandments in every aspect of life, even when it was dangerous. And it also highlights the importance of communal obligation, even in the face of persecution.
Yeah, his son, Tobias, also embarks on quite an adventure, right?
Yes. Tobias's journey to recover family money in a distant land, it's full of twists and turns. It's a classic coming-of-age story, but it's also infused with these deeper theological themes about divine providence, the importance of family, and the dangers lurking in a world where faithfulness is constantly tested.
And amidst all this adventure, we get some pretty specific ethical teachings from Tobit to his son. I'm thinking of that passage where he stresses the importance of almsgiving, not just as a good deed, but as something more profound.
It's more than just charity. It's a spiritual investment. Tobit tells him, give alms from your possessions. Yeah. Do not turn your face away from anyone who is poor, and the face of God will not be turned away from you. It's this beautiful idea that generosity has a ripple effect, not only impacting those in need, but also drawing us closer to God.
It makes me think about how we view charity today. Do we see it as an obligation?
Right.
A social safety net? Or something more deeply connected to our spiritual lives?
It's a question worth pondering. Tobit's words really challenge us to consider the deeper motivations behind our giving and the potential transformative power of generosity, both for the giver and the receiver.
Now, Tobit also has some strong opinions about marriage, specifically advocating for marrying within the faith. He tells Tobias, "Do not take a wife from outside the family of your father. Remember, my child, that all your relatives were descended from Abraham. Therefore, my child, be mindful of your relatives."
That's right. He sees endogamy, or marrying within the Jewish community, as crucial for preserving their cultural and religious heritage. And you can understand why he felt so strongly about it. They were living in a foreign land surrounded by all these different cultures, and he saw intermarriage as a threat to their identity.
Hmm. I can see his point, especially given the historical context. But it also raises questions about how we interpret these ancient texts in a modern world where interfaith relationships are more common and accepted.
Absolutely. It reminds us that these texts were written in a specific time and place, and we need to be mindful of that when we engage with them. It's not about blindly accepting every teaching, but understanding that historical context, and then wrestling with the ethical challenges they present.
It's like these texts are inviting us into a conversation, challenging us to think critically about our own values and beliefs.
Precisely. And speaking of challenging beliefs, Tobit also reflects another fascinating aspect of this period, the growing interest in angels and demons.
You're talking about Raphael, the disguised angel who accompanies Tobias on his journey, and that whole battle with the demon Asmodeus.
Exactly. These elements weren't just meant to add a supernatural thrill to the story. They reflected that evolving religious landscape of the Second Temple period, where angelology and demonology were becoming increasingly prominent.
It's almost like a glimpse into the popular imagination of the time, the way they understood the spiritual forces at work in the world.
Right. And remember that beautiful prayer Tobias offers on his wedding night. It, too, reflects the evolving nature of prayer during this period. It's not just a petition for personal needs, but a structured expression of praise, acknowledging God's role in creation and aligning personal desires with God's will.
It's a model of prayer that's had a lasting impact, hasn't it?
Absolutely. We see echoes of this structure in both Jewish and Christian liturgy to this day. It reminds us that prayer isn't just about asking for things, it's about connecting with the divine, aligning ourselves with a larger purpose.
Okay, so we've explored the world of Tobit. What other texts from this period offer insights into the lives and beliefs of Jews in the diaspora?
Well, there are those intriguing additions to the book of Daniel, specifically the stories of Susanna, Bel, and the dragon. These tales offer a glimpse into the challenges and tensions that arose from living in a predominantly Gentile society.
Let's dive into those next. I'm really curious to see how these stories reflect the dynamics between Jews and their neighbors in the diaspora.
These additions to Daniel, they're quite different from those prophetic visions that we see in the rest of the book. They're more like short stories, almost like folk tales. But they have some really pointed commentary about social dynamics and religious differences.
Yeah, the story of Susanna, that really caught my attention. It's set in Babylon, and we see this Jewish community that seems to have a degree of self-governance, like they're using the Torah as their legal code.
Yeah.
But then we get this shocking accusation against Susanna,
right,
and it reveals kind of like a darker side to the community.
It's a story that explores that potential for corruption and the abuse of power, even within a religious community.
Mm.
These two elders, respected figures, they use their position to try to coerce Susanna into an adulterous act. And when she refuses, they falsely accuse her, relying on the Deuteronomic law that requires two witnesses for conviction.
It's a chilling reminder that power can corrupt, regardless of religious affiliation. But then we have a young Daniel who steps in and exposes their lies. It's almost like a courtroom drama, with Daniel using his wit and logic to unravel their scheme.
Daniel's role is fascinating. He's portrayed as this righteous figure who sees through deception and champions justice. It's a theme that resonates throughout these additions to Daniel, this idea of a faithful individual standing up against corruption and challenging those who abuse their power.
And then we have Bel and the Dragon, two stories that take a more satirical approach, almost poking fun at Gentile worship practices.
These stories are definitely more pointed in their critique. In the Bel story, Daniel cleverly exposes the priest's trickery, showing that the offerings supposedly consumed by the god Bel are actually being eaten by the priests themselves. It's a challenge to the legitimacy of idol worship, presenting it as a sham perpetrated by those who benefit from it.
And then there's that scene with the dragon where Daniel kills it with this concoction of hair and pitch, making its stomach burst. It's almost comical, but it has this underlying message about the impotence of these so-called gods.
Right. The author is using humor and exaggeration to highlight the absurdity of worshiping these creatures.
Right.
It's important to remember, though, that these stories were written from a particular perspective, one that viewed monotheism as superior to polytheism.
Right.
We need to be mindful of that when we interpret them.
So these additions to Daniel, they offer a glimpse into those interreligious tensions of the time, but they also showcase the ways diaspora Jews might have used stories and satire to assert their own beliefs and challenge what they saw as false worship.
Exactly. They weren't just passively adapting to their environment. They were finding creative ways to engage with it, to critique it, and to advocate for their own understanding of the divine.
Okay, so we've got this mix of adventure, ethical teachings, and even a bit of social commentary in these texts. What about Baruch? It seems to strike a different tone, more introspective and reflective.
Baruch is often overlooked, but it's a fascinating book, especially for understanding the emotional and spiritual impact of exile. It's a tapestry of different genres. We have confession, lament, wisdom, poetry, and even prophetic pronouncements.
I was struck by the way Baruch grapples with the question of why the exile happened. There's this powerful acknowledgement of the people's sins and a call for repentance. It's not just blaming others, it's this deep introspection, this recognition that their actions have consequences.
There's this poignant line, "We have sinned, done wrong, acted wickedly, and rebelled, turning aside from your commandments and ordinances." It's a confession, but it's also a recognition that they've turned away from God's path. And the key to restoration, according to Baruch, lies in returning to that path. Mm-hmm. In embracing Torah as a source of wisdom and guidance.
So even in exile, even amidst the hardship and uncertainty, there's this affirmation of the covenant relationship with God, this belief that they can find their way back.
Exactly. And amidst that lament and confession, Baruch also offers a glimmer of hope. There are these beautiful passages about the restoration of Jerusalem, the return from exile, and the future blessings that await those who remain faithful.
It's like holding on to that spark of hope, that belief that even in the darkest of times, God hasn't abandoned them.
And connected to Baruch is another short text, the letter of Jeremiah. It's almost like a pep talk to those exiles, warning them against being seduced by the allure of Gentile worship.
Yeah, it's pretty blunt in its critique of idol worship. There's that line where the author, writing as if he were the prophet Jeremiah, describes these idols as lifeless gods of wood and stone plastered over with gold and silver.
It's like he's trying to inoculate them against that pressure to conform, to assimilate into the surrounding culture. He's saying, don't be fooled by the outward appearance of these gods. They're powerless and empty.
It's a theme that resonates even today, right? We're constantly bombarded with messages and trends, ideologies. It's a reminder to think critically, to question what we're being told, and to stay grounded in our own values and beliefs.
Absolutely. It's about discerning what's truly valuable and meaningful amidst all the noise and distractions of the world.
Okay, so we've seen how these texts offer insights into the challenges and complexities of diaspora life, the struggles to maintain their identity, those ethical dilemmas, the tensions with their Gentile neighbors. But there's another aspect of this period that I'm really curious to explore, the evolution of Jewish beliefs about the afterlife. It seems like this was a time of significant shifts and developments in that area.
You're absolutely right. And it's a topic that's both fascinating and relevant as it touches on those enduring human questions about what happens after death, the nature of the soul, and the possibility of an afterlife.
Let's dive into that next. I'm eager to see how these texts reflect the evolving beliefs about the afterlife and how those beliefs might have shaped their understanding of life in the present. So we've explored those challenges of diaspora life, the rise of anti-Semitism, and the resilience of Jewish communities. But now we're diving into something that has always captivated human imagination, the afterlife. It seems like this period saw some fascinating developments in Jewish beliefs about what happens after we die.
It was a time of really significant shifts, moving away from that traditional concept of Sheol, that shadowy underworld, towards more defined notions of heaven and hell, judgment, and even resurrection. This evolution was driven by a lot of factors, cultural exchange, philosophical debates, and even those experiences of persecution and martyrdom.
Yeah, it's fascinating how those real-world experiences can shape our beliefs about the afterlife. So what were some of those cultural influences at play here?
Well, during the Second Temple period, there was a lot of interaction with other cultures, particularly with the Greeks and the Persians. Zoroastrianism, a Persian religion, had a really profound impact. It emphasized this cosmic battle between good and evil, with a final judgment and a clear division between the righteous, who would be rewarded in heaven, and the wicked, who would face punishment in hell.
So these Zoroastrian ideas, along with Greek philosophical concepts about the soul and the afterlife, they started to kind of seep into Jewish thought, challenging those more traditional beliefs.
Exactly. And it wasn't just an intellectual exercise. Think about what was happening during this period, the destruction of the First Temple, the Babylonian exile, the ongoing struggles for autonomy under foreign rulers. When people are facing oppression and suffering, those questions about justice, reward, and punishment, they become even more pressing.
It makes sense. If you're being persecuted for your faith, the idea of a future resurrection, a time when God would vindicate the righteous, that would be incredibly comforting.
Absolutely. And we see those ideas reflected so vividly in texts like 2 Maccabees. Remember that story about the mother and her 7 sons who were tortured and killed for refusing to violate Jewish law?
Oh, yes. That story is both heartbreaking and inspiring.
It is. And what's so striking is their unwavering faith, their belief in a future resurrection where God would reward their faithfulness. One of the sons even tells their tormentor, "You accursed wretch, you dismiss us from this present life, but the King of the universe will raise us up to an everlasting renewal of life because we have died for his laws."
That takes incredible courage to face death with that kind of conviction. It speaks to the power of those beliefs, not just as abstract theological concepts, but as sources of strength and solace in the face of suffering.
And those ideas about resurrection weren't limited to 2 Maccabees. We see similar themes in Daniel, where it says that those who sleep in the dust of the earth shall awake, some to everlasting life, and some to shame and everlasting contempt. And in the Wisdom of Solomon, where the righteous are said to be in the hand of God, and no torment will ever touch them.
So it seems like these ideas were gaining momentum, becoming more central to Jewish thought during this period. But I imagine there were also debates and disagreements about what resurrection meant, right?
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. It wasn't a monolithic belief system. Some envisioned a bodily resurrection, while others believed it was more of a spiritual transformation. There were also questions about the timing of judgment. Would it happen immediately after death or at some future end time?
It's like they were wrestling with these huge questions that we still grapple with today. What happens to us after we die? Is there a soul that survives? What is the nature of that existence?
Exactly. And those debates reflect that intellectual vibrancy of Second Temple Judaism. It wasn't a static religion. It was evolving, engaging with new ideas, and grappling with those big existential questions.
So what does this all mean for us today? Why should we care about these ancient beliefs about the afterlife?
Well, for one, it gives us a deeper understanding of the historical development of Jewish thought and how those ideas influence both Judaism and Christianity. But it also connects us to that universal human search for meaning, that desire to make sense of life and death and what might lie beyond.
It's a reminder that those questions have been pondered for centuries across cultures and time periods, and those ancient texts can still offer insights and perspectives that resonate with us today.
They certainly can. And they challenge us to think deeply about our own beliefs, about what we hope for, what we fear, and what we believe about the ultimate meaning of life and death.
This deep dive has been a fascinating exploration of Jewish life and thought during a really pivotal period. We've seen the challenges they faced in the diaspora, the ways they adapted and resisted, and the evolution of their beliefs. I hope this leaves you, our listeners, with a sense of how these ancient texts can still speak to us today, offering insights into the human condition, the search for meaning, and the enduring power of faith and resilience. Thanks for joining us on The Deep Dive, and we'll catch you next time.